This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
You're listening to Joy 94.9 Saturday Magazine with Nick Tolhurst and Jeff Hood. And joining us in the studio for the rest of this hour in our journey segment is Melbourne musician Mandy Kane. Mandy, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are things? I'm not going to tell our audience anything at all about you. I'm going to let you tell us all about yourself.
I wonder, where do you get a name like Mandy from?
Well, you see, it's very interesting because I think actually Mandy Patinkin is in the country or was.
He will be here next Wednesday, according to everybody. Yeah.
Because I think I saw him on Kerry Ann, actually. Yes, Mandy Patinkin. So it can be a man's name.
Yep.
However, it sort of just popped into my head when I was about 18.
Oh, okay.
After a big night.
Mm. Yes.
And I just decided that that's what I would be called from now on.
Excellent.
And it was tied in with the sort of carnival-themed show that I was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So...
So it could actually be a very bisexual name, like you. Man and the beginning of
Dyke. Was that deliberate then?
Man D. Mm. Yeah, that's right. Was it deliberate, the androgynous thing?
Yeah.
In a sense, yeah, I didn't really want people to, you know, make assumptions as to...
Who or what were when they saw the name.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when you hear the name, you expect to see... A woman, and it's kind of it's nice of that's challenging right. people's expectations in that way.
Well, sometimes people see a woman, sometimes people see a man.
Yeah, good stuff. So, tell us about your music.
Well, it's kind of I guess people liken it to David Bowie a lot because, of course, he's my greatest idol.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a borderline between at the moment. It's going down an electronic path. I do a lot of remixing as well, so I kind of tie that in with it.
Mm.
More and more, I'm moving into production.
Okay. Look, I'm sorry to be a fuddy-duddy, but maybe just tell us about remixing, because people go, huh?
Remixing, all right.
What does that mean for you?
To do a remix, to create one, essentially, is to get the files of the original song, the individual tracks, like the vocals, the guitars, bass, drums.
Is that hard to do? When you hear so much stuff, I wonder how that... old stuff.
You take it all and you isolate the tracks.
But is it hard to actually get the authorization for it?
The ones that I do are mainly from new acts, up-and-coming kind of acts.
Okay.
So they're all... They've just gone to the studio, recorded, and then they want a different version
of the
song.
They don't mind you doing it, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, I mean, if you did do an older track, it'd be great. In fact, Bowie is making the files for Space Oddity available very shortly.
Really?
Oh, wow.
For everyone's remix, which is fantastic. So I'll be doing one of those.
Mm.
So you get all these tracks?
You get them all, apart, and you cut them up, and you put new beats behind them and reassemble them, essentially, to make a new track. But you still... Mm. Maintain, you keep the initial hook. Well, I try to. Hmm. You keep the essence of the original track.
Otherwise, it's become so totally something else.
But record other tracks that you then remix or mix in with the originals.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like it's a mashup in a sense.
Yeah. So I mean, it's the kind of thing in a more obvious sort of way that Natalie Cole did with doing stuff with her dead father and all
yes.
that. That's a very elaborate sort of
it
remix,
is a bit
isn't
more,
it?
But this time around, you're putting your own creative stamp on it.
Yeah, that's right.
To responding to it, yeah.
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 Yeah, that's good, because you see, on CDs, remix and radio edit, and...
Is this just another way of flogging the song all over again? But it's more than that.
Well, see, and it's just becoming more and more of an art form, and if you look online, there are sites like The Hype Machine and recordlabel.com, and they're just full of, recordlabel.com actually give you, I brought a couple today, just free remixes, like from Moby, all these people, just the latest stuff done by these underground remixes. And it's a real art form, in clubs, particularly in the UK, it's what people will prefer to listen to.
It is a different way of doing music, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. It's moving away from the idea of the artist, the creation, that's it, there's only one way to do it. It's a bit different to, like a long time ago, like in the 60s, it was not unusual for many artists to cover a Beatles song, for instance, and everyone did covers, but that doesn't seem to happen anymore. It's kind of...
That's right. Well, this is the new method of doing that, in a sense. It's also, though, a collaboration between the remixer and the... artists.
The original artist,
So, when you've got new stuff being put down today, what would a big number of tracks be that you would record? Like, what's the average?
For a full album?
Yeah.
It varies. Because record labels now are on a decline in terms of their control over artists, creative freedom means that artists will tend to want to put out more material because they've got so many ideas and they just want to get them all out there. So now we're seeing the re-emergence of all of these LPs that go for, you know, well over an hour. You know, it's just going back to the days of like Pink Floyd, you know, where they could just do records that where one song went for about
and not limited to one side of a piece of vinyl or even a CD these days. Yeah, so no, you can just keep churning it out and load downloading.
I was thinking, I actually asked the question the wrong way. I think I was thinking more of channels of music, like when you're recording something.
How many parts?
Yeah, how many would you have?
You're getting technical here.
Well, no, I'm just curious because I mean, originally, you know, it was all done on one track with the old mono recordings. You know, many centuries and decades ago, it was a one-off thing and that was it. But but now with the mixing, how many? Like, if you're doing a song with fairly strong music backing and so on, how many channels would you record on?
Well, I'm a bit of a shocker for that. When I'm producing bands and particularly electronic music, I tend to layer a lot of sounds. So you're looking at probably well over, when I got a final session, well over 100 tracks.
Wow.
You're not overproducing there, are you?
Well, what I do is it's all in the mixing of it then. When you have all of those tracks, even just I layer a lot of vocal parts and even drum sounds. So I might, for a kick drum, I might have 5 different kick drums.
Yeah.
But I'll have them layered together so that one is mixed really, really softly and then just to give it a little bit of a crisp top, and then I have the really woofy
Shades of Phil Spector and his wall of sound going.
So
there,
with 100 tracks, you could just about remix your own stuff, put out sort of an annual remix of the same song. This is the 2010 remix and 2011 remix.
I have one song and I'm working it to death. So we'll listen. We got some of your stuff here today to play.
I think I brought a couple of remixes actually.
That's good. We'll have a listen to something in a minute. What got you started in the music business?
It was In Excess started me, actually, seeing Michael Hutchence in action when I was about 9 years old.
And as a 9-year old, what did you notice about Michael Hutchence in action?
All the things I notice now, believe it or not. No, he was fantastic. He was just a brilliant performer, the ultimate entertainer. You know, he had this natural charisma that I haven't really seen in any up and coming performers from Australia. The only exception, I guess, are people like. You know, I brought a UMI track, Tim Rogers. I love Tim Rogers, but he's kind of appealing in a different way to Michael Hutchence. Hutchence had this universal quality that people sort of related to, I think. And he had a great voice.
As a young boy, and then you identify as a bisexual person yourself?
It depends what day of the week it is.
Yes, it is. Did you see any of that in him?
That sort of sexuality, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that was the whole appeal.
And how do you think his appeal works across gender like that?
A bit like Mick Jagger, I suppose. It's this kind of, again, it's androgynous in a sense. You can't define what it is really, but it's something that people are born with, I think.
Yeah. But it's a different sort of, I mean, he's clearly a guy, a man. You know, there's no mistaking Michael Hutchence for that. Whereas with David Bowie and his various incarnations, it really blurred the boundaries.
In a sense, though, see, Bowie, I think, even forced it. You know, he wanted people to really see the androgyny and it was more of an artistic statement. Whereas with Hutchence, he just had this sensitivity that you could detect. Like
who he was that came across more naturally. Yeah, because Bowie obviously was much more extravagant in pushing that androgynous
idea.
He's
very flamboyant and he's bordered on being incredibly pretentious throughout most of his career.
Oh, yeah. Thank God he did, yes.
But, you know, that's what makes him appealing.
Because there were some other less successful androgynous performers like Liberace and...
Not the Liberty, yes.
A few others, but
Marilyn.
Not quite the same thing as David Bowie, were they?
No, I mean, that's why I headed up this hour with Lou Reed's Vicious, because that's from the Transformer album, which was really a Bowie creation in many ways, wasn't it? Without David Bowie, you would have none of that in there. Now, listen, we've got CD 1, CD 2. What should we listen to now?
Well, now, let me see. I've got my little list here on my phone. I suppose we could listen to a Bowie track, shall we?
Yep. Where is that?
Number 3.
On CD 1?
Yes.
Okay, tell us about this one.
This one is called Dead Man Walking, and this was from an album called Earthling that he did, which was... When you listen to it, it was kind of around the time when jungle was big and he was just experimenting with electronica and trying to push boundaries.
So what should we capture from this?
Joy 94.9, the life of Melbourne. You're listening to
really?
us.
Really? is it?
Well, that's just a little kind of sting that
you,
I made
you
up.
Just threw that in. Oh,
it's very nice.
Absolutely.
The life of Melbourne. The life there you of go. Melbourne. Joy 94.9, the life of Melbourne.
It is.
Hope you're having a wonderful day on this very sunny midwinter's day in Melbourne.
Now, we've just been treated to a really healthy dose of some slight, not vintage, David Bowie.
No, within the last 10 years, which is, you know, how long's Bowie? When was Bowie's first stuff out? Would have been
late
70s, late 60s. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It kind of hit the scene, I remember, when I was about 70, I reckon, yeah. 71.
Yeah.
When I started, yeah, because yeah. I'm just thinking about when I was at school and the first boy who came to school with some Bowie makeup on, some Ziggy Stardust type makeup or something like that.
He wouldn't have got out of there alive.
I was a special school. Mm. Anyway, we're talking with Mandy Kane. What was your schooling like, Mandy?
My schooling was about a lot of makeup. Towards the end, it was about realizing who I was and sort of making a bit of a statement in that regard.
Difficult time to do this?
So when you say makeup, you mean like wearing makeup to school? What sort of response? Was it a co-ed school or a boys' school?
It was co-ed.
Yeah.
Now, the thing was, I actually won a scholarship to go to Halebury.
Yeah.
And went there in year seven for a term. And being an all-boys school, it was very much sport-focused.
Yeah.
And I was not at all.
Yeah.
And that didn't go down too well with me at all. And I left after the first term, then went to a co-ed school in Dandenong. And
a big change.
Yeah. It was a big change, but it was actually I found the culture there to be more honest.
Yeah.
You know, it was more level. Mm. Everybody was on an equal footing because everyone had it tough, basically.
Mm.
And I made a lot of good friends at that school, and I had a lot of good people who stuck up for me when I started doing this. And it was about late year 10 and I guess 11 and 12.
Mm.
And I just, you know, started wearing makeup to school, but then really started being creative and writing songs and producing and things like that. So I think even the jocks at school recognized that I had this ability that they valued and they respected, which was really
interesting. Do you think there was something, I'm just thinking about that, like I imagine the first response, if I think back to my schooling days, you would have been, puffed a faggot, all this sort of stuff. But being more out there than just being seen as gay, like actually making a big point of it, did that earn you some sort of odd respect from the jocks in a sense?
It did, because they, of course, love to dress up.
Women.
They love to wear makeup on, you know, their bucks nights and all, you know,
footy nights,
it goes through their entire lives.
Yeah.
So to them, it was something that they did. They admired it, I think.
Yeah.
And I kind of did it in a way that wasn't shoving it in people's faces. It was just a natural thing. You know,
if you perceived as gay, it's like poofter, you know, and the whole thing of, you know, weak and outcast and all that kind of stuff. But if you're doing something as brave as wearing makeup, there's almost a like, well, he might be a poofter, but he's pretty bloody brave.
Yeah, so what do you think were saying about yourself? Were you saying this is a sexual identity, or what was that for you?
I guess I was just playing around and really experimenting,
challenging
and seeing what fit, you know.
Challenging the norms.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a fabulous thing.
It was wonderful. And a lot of kids now, you know, it's funny because emo culture now with boys, it's acceptable now for boys to wear makeup.
Yeah.
You know, teenage boys in the past, if they'd been, you know, around the time that I was at school, if they'd worn makeup, would have been considered to be complete freaks.
Yeah.
Now, every boy who's an emo will wear...
Emo's a bit like goth sort of stuff.
Yeah. So it kind of crosses over. It's almost that new romantic thing too.
Mm.
It's interesting that something as simple as makeup, that women wear makeup presumably to enhance their looks, why shouldn't men? It's logically ridiculous that men can't or don't, and yet to do it, it's seen like pushing the cultural boundaries in such an extreme way.
Well, that's right, because I never thought anything of it, and it was just the easiest thing to do. And it did look good. And the other part of it was that I actually had really bad skin in high school. And so I was kind of, half of it was to cover that up.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, well, I've covered it up, so I may as well go the other step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you said at that time you started being creative and writing music. Was it towards the end of high school that you started writing?
I'd been writing pretty much all through.
Right.
Were you
trained musically as a child?
No. It was all by ear. And I got a guitar when I was about 12. Mm-hmm. And then from there started playing and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few lessons, guitar lessons. I met this guy in high school. There's an organization in Dandenong called the Muso Network. I don't know if they're still going. It was a government-funded thing.
Yeah.
And they would take in kids, and it was basically, it ended up being street kids and kids who liked music, and it was a bit of a dropout not drop-in
drop-out drop-in yeah yeah
drop-in centre yeah. for them. So I kind of became involved with the administration. They had like volunteers, you know, kids who volunteered to kind of keep it all together and put on the shows. So I would do that, and I met this guy Brad, who was like this new age hippie, and he taught me. He was a brilliant guitarist, an exceptional guitarist. He was basically, if he'd really focused, he could have been classically trained. But he taught me all about Hendrix and all about, you know, he went through, gave me a life's lesson in the history of music. So I've got him to thank for that. I don't know why.
So what is this about? This is something we were talking about earlier. Just recently looking at the Triple J Top 20 that came out. There's a lot of oldish sort of music. What's this fascination with old stuff these days? I'm bemused by this.
It's very interesting because we technology sort of came to a peak, and we had all of this electronic music and synthesized pop music, and that still exists, but people still crave the sound of a band, like an old, like now you got stuff out, there are new bands out who, actually James Cain, who I'll talk about in a minute, introduced me to a band whose name escapes me now, but they sound just like Cream.
Yeah, really?
Oh, right.
And they're huge, you know, they're really, they are the cool school at the moment.
Wow.
So that kind of sound is back. Jet were another example where it was a retro sound that became popular.
But it had something, it's something new again to add.
Yeah, yeah. Because now we have the sonic ability that we didn't have back then. So again, as a producer, you're always looking for things like that. You're looking for a way to track things with a band that sound analog and warm and rich, like those old records did.
Yeah,
yeah, and I think, and what's interesting too is the resurgence of sales of vinyls. Like there's a, I can't even remember now, a friend of mine just showed me a recent thing that she bought that was, had two vinyl albums plus the two CDs in a,
and you pay through the nose for it.
Well, it was over $100 bucks, but it was like, but they're actually issuing it as, it's first release issue of, in vinyl, which is quite amazing. And I must say, I still do like the sound of vinyl. I've got a lot of old vinyls at home.
Can we, we'll listen to a track in, after a few announcements. What are we going to listen to? James Cain, is it?
Yes, James Cain. So James is 17 years old, and I came across him because he MySpace messaged me one day and said, cool name, and that was it. So I thought, who are you?
Another
got in
Cain,
touch with him. Yeah, another Cain. Maybe some distant relative in another life. But he is a remixer and upcoming producer and DJs weekly at a night called Fashion Keyboard, which is jam-packed with, like, you know, over 1,000 of the coolest indie kids in Melbourne. So he's done this remix of an act that's based in, I think, Paris. Really, it's Paris, London, and the US. They're split across. And the act is called Appaloosa. And I don't know what the name of the track is, but he's done this remix, and it's fantastic.
And just before we hear this, you were telling me in one of the breaks earlier that the people who, like, there are some really creative remix people, say, in the UK that people go to hear their remixes. And so I just wanted to make the point that, you know, someone who does remixing is very, is a creative artist in a sense. It's not just like technically sitting down and twiddling
a few knobs. Stealing people's stuff and things,
Well, James
it's a
has
creative
the,
product in itself.
He's got a musical knowledge for a 17-year-old that absolutely astounds me. Yeah. He knows not only electronic music, but everything from everything.
Wow.
Well, thanks. We're talking with Mandy Cain, and we'll listen to some of James Cain's music in just a second.
This week in MCV, we talk to gay dads James and Steve about their family, which they're about to expand from 3 to 5. We talk to James Cannon, gay Colombian author, about his new book, Tales from the Town of Widows, and find out why they're doing the gender mash down at the Gasworks Arts Park. Meanwhile, at the Melbourne International Film Festival, John Hurt reprises his role as Britain's stately homo, Quentin Crisp, and the new series of The Amazing Race features a gay father and gay son duo. All this in MCV this week.
MCV, a proud Joy sponsor.
Mistake, a lifelike remix. Joy 94.9.
Yes, that, well, that one was actually James.
Oh, that was James, sorry. That was, oh, that was Appaloosa, yeah.
Your name's Cain. Yes.
But yes, it's a very good remix, I think.
Joy 94.9, Saturday Magazine with Jeff and Nick, and our guest is Melbourne musician Mandy Cain. Mandy, I wanted to ask you, we were talking a little bit before about you starting in high school to write, and you said that you'd been writing for a while. Tell us about what you write, what inspires you to write, and what's your own creative process?
Well, a lot of it, I tend to work from visual stimuli a lot. So if I see something, I tend to have, when I'm producing or remixing or anything to do with sound, because that's part of the writing process for me. It's building up sounds and then, you know, forming them into a song. But I tend to have a TV running or something with some interesting vision on it, and I kind of just glance at that while I'm composing.
So to put it in simple music terms, what comes first, the melody or the lyrics?
It can come with a concept often. Right. So I'll have an idea of what it's going to be about or what I want to write about or a title, and then everything will come from there. But sometimes, and more recently, it's literally been sitting down and playing with sounds and looking at the picture, and sort of it's almost a trance-like state that you slip into. And
so is it a kind of a... Does it come as a feeling for you, or does it come as a kind of a multiple image of
It's a vision, but it's also a feeling. It's when I get a certain feeling, it's like butterflies, you know, and I tend to have like a glass of wine, sit down, stare at something interesting and play chords.
It's not zen-like, that but that sort of extraordinarily creative focus. Everything, the whole life comes...
It's a bit hypnotic.
It's about where you're supposed to be at that time.
Which is where, if you think, for all of us, it's one of our most creative times, going to sleep, waking up, that whole dreamlike state when you're half in a dream.
It's like
the world becomes a bit weirder and a bit you get a bit out of reality, and that's the creative space, isn't it?
Well, I'm fascinated by lucid dreaming. I've been doing a lot of research about that lately, and it's interesting. You know, you sometimes wonder whether this is in fact that reality. What is reality? You know, it is that dreamlike state that you need to capture. Well, I like to capture that, and then it will come out in the form of ideas, and then I'll structure it. So then I'll switch off from that state and go into a more clinical approach and really analyze what I've done.
So you then would look at the music and look at, you know, harmonies, chord patterns, what you want to add to it, and restructure the words in a more conscious, rational sort of way.
Yeah. But what's your art saying about you?
Well, I hope that it reflects who I am as a person. In the past, I was more concerned with creating an image for someone else to understand, you know, so I would tend to edit myself more than what I do now. So now it's just more, because I don't have any expectations of any grand success with my own music, you know. In the past, I was thinking from a record company's perspective, being signed to Warner and everything, of what the consumer would want, whereas I'm doing that now with other acts. But I'm not doing it with myself. So,
but see, in a way, that's more strategic than creative, or it's been creative about the strategy, whereas the creative stuff is about doing what you want, because you ultimately can't know how it will be received. You write a piece of music, Nick and I hear it and have totally different responses to it. Yet it's got to come from you. You can't write it for me, or he might hate it.
That's it.
That's the struggle, isn't it?
And the funny thing is, if I look at another artist, that's why with the production work, I can tell if that's going to work or if it's not with the general public. I know what people want to hear from different demographics, but I can't do that with myself. I've never had that ability to be able to know.
No, I don't think. I mean, that's the level of objectivity about your own self is probably not something we could really do in any context, really.
I like that this is getting a bit philosophical now, but the whole concept of intersubjectivity rather than my subject putting onto this object, it's like two subjects interacting, and it's always the case with any creative process and an audience, it's two subjectivities meeting somehow, and it's in the meeting that the meaning is made in what is experienced.
Thus back to Jeff Hood. Well, I'm with you there.
Well,
do you have an immediate connection with an audience, or is there some sense of remove because you work in a recording context?
I still do shows, and that's where you interact, and that's in its purest form. But I find it difficult to make music for myself at the moment. I'm more interested in working with other people and developing other people, just because I don't know. I can still have a creative input, but I can see that grow. You know, I can see a person mature and develop, and having been through that myself, I like to be able to adapt that. It's a very interesting thing.
You'd be learning something in the process yourself, wouldn't you?
Definitely, yeah. Mm. And I find it really inspiring. And I think there are so many talented kids out there, and songwriters, producers, remixers, you know, who just... it's the right time for them to be creative at the moment. Mm. And I think all that's missing is, you know, someone to actually guide them and help steer them in the right direction, and not from, like, a record company perspective going, do this.
Yeah. Now, we were talking earlier about you wearing makeup to school and about the whole issue of sexuality. I just want to move on to that in terms of you know, talking a little bit about your own sexuality, but also what was interesting was the idea of exploring the idea, the notion of boundaries. And like I was saying, you know, we were saying in the break that a lot of people in the gay community would feel that that's like a betrayal for someone to call themselves bisexual, or you can't make up your mind, or get off the fence, or.
Yeah.
But I actually don't think sexuality is rigid, like, you know, you've got to be on one side of the. I don't think that's how we function. How would you describe yourself, and what's your own journey and experience around your sexuality?
Well, it's you're absolutely right, because it can't be restricted to, well, as soon as you start being adamantly gay or, you know, adamantly straight, well then there's a problem, I think, because if you're really, really vocal about it either way, then you're covering up something, because you should just be comfortable with who you are regardless. It doesn't matter.
Do you think there's a point for being adamant, though, in terms of like social change? Like in the 60s and 70s, I think there was a time to be adamant, wasn't there?
Yeah, for acceptance, I think.
Yeah.
It's more the tolerance and the acceptance that needs to be fought for. But I don't think it's right to say that, you cannot be bisexual in a gay community. You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Do you get any flack for it? That you notice?
No. Haven't noticed it. Yeah. No, I don't. I've never experienced... I've never had a massive problem with it. I've been pretty lucky, you know. No one seems to mind. Everything else sort of counters it, I think. Mm. Creatively, people just sort of overlook that. Mm. And that's
so
how I'd like it.
Have you been in any substantial relationships where it becomes... Well, it becomes an issue?
With partners?
Yeah, either or.
Not really. It's never really been an issue. I'm attracted to people for lots of different reasons, and it's, you know, it's either an intellectual attraction or, it's a combination of things. Mm. And it doesn't matter whether they're men or women or whatever. It really doesn't matter to me.
There has never been a thing of a woman thinking you're going to run off with a man, or a male partner thinking you're going to run off with a woman. Or
no, again, very lucky. Confused, very, very lucky. Yeah. No, it's not a huge thing. But at the moment, I found, in terms of relationships, I'm just happier being on my own, and you're open then to every possibility.
Mm. Mm. How old are you?
27.
27, so in certain terms, you're still pretty young. Do you think this is a reflection on your generation at the moment? Is that a fair comment, that people are kind of okay about fluidity?
I would hope so.
You would hope so? Mm. But what's your sense of it? I mean, you're out there with the crowd and the younger people.
Well, my... you know, group of friends are very accepting of everyone. Mm. And I would like to see that in the wider community, really. I think that's how people should behave. Unfortunately, a lot of people still have this brick wall about homosexuality and bisexuality. They just won't touch
it. We do. This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.